From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A voter news service computer breakdown Tuesday forced broadcast and cable news to suddenly do without exit poll data, a last-minute monkey wrench in the works for organizations already chastened by the reporting fiasco of Election 2000. Gone were the detailed breakdowns of voting patterns, demographic segment by segment, replaced by old-fashioned broad analysis of the voters' will. Producer-at-large Mike Pesca, who watched the coverage as always with nearly pathological attention, was struck both by the exit polling data that the media didn't much need and the earlier campaign tracking polls that the media didn't much heed. Hi, Mike.
Indeed.
All right. So, Mike, how was the first election without VNS?
It was pretty careful. It was the Heinz ketchup election. It may take a while, but, you know, when it finally comes out in the end, it'll be worth it.
Yeah, but without the VNS data, did you find yourself wondering if New Hampshire's Latinas, for example, went for Sununu or Shaheen? Did you miss the detail?
No, I didn't. I don't think anyone did. The oldest cliche in politics is when you're trailing in the polls before an election, you say, you know, there's only one poll that matters, and that's the poll on election day. And I don't think they mean the VNS poll. I think they mean when people actually vote. Now, the VNS data is useful for academics, and there's actually strong reason to think that they'll be able to recover all that data for future studies. But the networks all promise us news and analysis, and they prove that they were able to take voting trends, and from those trends, smart people could make good analysis. This is what Aaron Brown did.
I just think that in close races, one of the things that people thought a lot about tonight is who supports the president. We are post 9/11. We are perhaps on the edge of a war with Iraq. We want people who support the president, and that's how some of these broke. And maybe I'm inventing a theory, or maybe that's in fact what happened, but it feels that way.
All right. Now, that was reasonable and non-controversial. Was there anything you saw that was particularly good or particularly awful?
I choose to take the second part of that question first and possibly leave the first part off the table. Yeah, there was one thing that was my pet peeve. The race for the Senate in Texas was supposed to be this close and exciting race. And it was an interesting race because you had the black mayor of Dallas, Ron Kirk, running against the Bush Rove designated candidate. But it was never close. Yet the media continued on with this fiction that this was some barn burner of a race. And right up until 2 days before the election, Sunday New York Times Week in Review, they reviewed six close races, and Texas was on the list. And the one race, if the Texas race took away attention from anything, it was the race for Senate in Georgia, which came as a shock to everyone on election night. But it really shouldn't have.
No, that's the race where Max Cleland lost to Saxby Chambliss.
Right, Saxby Chambliss, or as MSNBC's expert Pat Cadell called him.
I'm really outraged by this. This guy got away with murder this year. And it's one of the few
races. Who's this guy?
This Chambliss Saxby. And I just feel very
Saxby
bad.
Chambliss.
Saxby Chambliss. Whichever you'd like. It's a weird name, isn't it?
Okay, anybody can make a mistake. But it was shocking that this war hero who lost an arm and both of his legs in Vietnam could lose on, of all issues, national security, that Max Cleland was soft on national security.
Right. That shock was registered on the in the expressions of most of the news that night. But look at the polls, and the polls were out there. They were telling you that the race was close. A week before the election, I was getting really upset at the Washington Post and the New York Times because they would write these stories about the close races and never include actual numbers. And that's a whole other discussion. Should you include what the polls are saying? The reason that they don't do it is because there's a fear that if you do too many polls, then you're covering horse race rather than policy. If the polls are inaccurate, you as the media could wind up skewing the election. However, there's also a thought that as a media consumer, I have the right to the data. And if I looked at the data, I would say, wait a minute, they're telling me Texas is close, but it's really not. Hey, wait a minute, look at Max Cleland. He could lose.
All right, so why weren't they looking at the numbers if they were clear enough?
It was as if on election night, Max Cleland's name stopped being Max Cleland and just became triple amputee Max Cleland. Here, listen to Judy Woodruff.
Max Cleland, they thought, as you said, triple amputee. There's no way the Republicans could beat him.
Now, I don't know how many of the national anchors actually looked into that race, but I'm somewhat of a political junkie. I watched a debate on C-SPAN. And I have to tell you, at the end, Max Cleland, although I'm sympathetic to the guy, he came off as a little bit out of touch. He ended with a statement, take it to the max with Max. And it was a little weird because he was getting hammered on points, on solid points, not on puns, the whole night by Chambliss. So if you actually watch that debate, you'd come away from it thinking that Cleland was in trouble, which he turned out to be.
Mike, I guess the question is this just carelessness? Is it egregious evidence of the media really being misleading in order to hype the drama of these campaigns? And does it have some sort of greater implication for democracy?
It's probably just carelessness. As far as implications for democracy, people in Georgia who were doing the actual voting did get a better picture of that race than we outside of Georgia were getting from the national media. But the final point is perhaps the next election cycle in a couple years, I wish they would publish more poll numbers and leave it up to the viewer and the reader to decide what races are the ones to watch. Because what did we find out and why were they being so careful in this election? Once you lose a news consumer's trust, it's a really difficult thing to regain.
All right, Mike. Well, thanks for your analysis. Now, get back to work.
If by work you mean watching the runoff in Louisiana, I sure will.
The White House Pool Report is a relatively brief synopsis of events written by a designated reporter to be used by the rest of the press corps. A few weeks back, the White House received this pool report. Time, Marine One pulled up at Andrews, 8:47. Wheels up for Air Force One, 8:57. Numbers of engines on Air Force One, 4. Time aloft, 1:16. Having your pool report distributed to the White House staff and 1,000 strangers, priceless. The author was Washington Post White House correspondent Dana Milbank, wryly referring to the fact that the once relatively exclusive pool reports are now spread indiscriminately to party hacks, lobbyists, anyone who cares, journalist or not. But the pool reports are one thing, a low-level annoyance for the White House. Where Dana Milbank has really managed to get under the administration's skin is in his newspaper. New York Times reporter Paul Krugman wrote in an op-ed piece last month that Milbank had become the target of a White House smear campaign.
I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago looking at a dozen or so examples of things that the president said that actually turned out not to be quite right. And that set off a furious response from the White House, which partially objected on factual grounds, but more than that, through a series of anonymous calls or in some cases actually using their names, called around town not to challenge the facts in the article, but actually to say that I had it in for them in the first place and that, sort of a shoot the messenger kind of thing.
Well, the title of the article was "For Bush, Facts Are Malleable." And although this may be a tradition among a succession of presidents, the fact is that Bush seems to have gotten a free ride on most of his misstatements, or so you contend.
Yes, he has. I mean, this is part of a larger ongoing debate about has the press been hard on Bush at all? And generally, it hasn't been. Now, there's a variety of reasons, the most obvious of which is we were attacked a year ago, and it's a very different climate. Whereas the Clinton administration became very used to sort of having the daily attacks on them, this is something that the Bush administration has not had. Now, the sort of thing I wrote is something that would have been written about the Clinton administration on any given day. So I think they just found it to be out of character with the sort of coverage they're used to getting.
And isn't that the point? Mark Halperin of ABC said that you're the one reporter who has questioned the actions of the government most consistently. This is a rather odd position to be in, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't view myself as leading some sort of a crusade here. The truth is, in other jobs, I covered the Clinton administration, I covered the Gore campaign, and in each of those times, I would get a certain amount of criticism for being unfair to the guy, and each of them assumed that I had a bias. Then they assumed I had a conservative bias. Now they assume I have a liberal bias. I mean, my bias is in terms of being a watchdog of trying to point out what the facts are. The truth is the president has thousands of people to go out there and say he's a great guy and he's doing everything terrific. I feel that our job is not to amplify that, but to take a critical look at things.
Do you feel sometimes that you're hanging out there by yourself, or perhaps that you're not long for this job?
Or long for this world? Well, you know, look, the my accountant says we're going to get through this IRS audit just fine. But no, I actually, when I get in these arguments with the administration, it actually has the perverse effect of sort of reinforcing my position on this beat that the newspaper couldn't and wouldn't allow me to change at this point in time when we are engaged in some sort of an exchange like this. So
that's a curious kind of job security. You keep ticking off the White House and the Washington Post will be too embarrassed to fire you because it'll look like capitulation.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting firing. I was. I hope that's not what they're thinking of doing. I was thinking of, you know, sort of more of a desk job where you can, which is the job I had before I started the White House beat.
The White House's main weapon against the press corps is to deny access if they get too irritated with what a particular reporter is writing. Have you been frozen out?
I have exactly as much access as I had when I began, which is to say not very much access at all. This administration does not release information. The truth is, if this administration were interested in rewarding and punishing correspondents to guide coverage in that way, they could do that. They just have not chosen to do that. So essentially, everybody is treated the same, which is to say, badly.
We've heard from a few White House reporters about the need for the occasional beet sweetener. These are stories that basically suck up to the administration in office. Mm-hmm. So how do you maintain your access and your sources if you refuse to write a puff piece now and then?
There have been times when I've written those sorts of stories that they call and want reprints for, and that I get scolded for buying the administration line too much.
And do you do it for the purposes of sweetening your beat?
I did a couple of those when I started out. I mean, I really believe that there's absolutely no use in doing that with this particular administration because the information is just going to be controlled in such a way. What we do doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what kinds of stories we're writing. But you could look at it another way, and it's a noble way. You just write what you believe is going on. And when I write something that's very favorable to the White House point of view, and believe it or not, that actually occurs quite regularly, I'm writing it because that is what appears to be the truth. So in a way, that this whole nefarious system has liberated us to actually tell the truth about what's going on.
Dana Milbank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dana Milbank is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post.
Next up, a guerrilla journalist feeds the beast in Chicago and films that probably won't be coming to a theater near you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Chicago Housing Authority is tearing down 50 residential high-rises, which have come to symbolize 40 years of policy failures. The gang-plagued buildings will be replaced by low-rise, mixed-income developments. Journalists are considered outsiders in these neighborhoods, and covering their final days is difficult without inside help. 54-year-old writer Jamie Calvin has taken on that mission. He operates a public housing website called viewfromtheground.com from a Southside Chicago tenement that is literally being torn down around him. On the Media's Ron Feimster has the story.
Outside the first floor office of viewfromtheground.com, workers hurled doors, cabinets, and broken wallboard out seven-story windows into dumpsters. rusty stoves and smelly refrigerators, line up in the courtyard waiting for the scrap hauler. On his website, Jamie Calvin covers an abandoned community.
It's an effort to contribute to the public discourse about public housing by way of a specific place. We try to do stories in such a way that we raise issues that have broader implication for the housing authority as a whole, and in some instances for national housing policy. But we always want to be sure that our reporting is grounded in the particulars of this place.
Residents call this place the House of Pain. It's part of Stateway Gardens, a Southside public housing development that once boasted 8 residential high-rises. 6 weeks ago, 4 were still standing when Housing Authority representatives went door-to-door looking for squatters.
Hello? Hey, housing? Hello? How you doing? Good. We're here from housing. You know the building is closing on Monday?
Okay.
We have DHS here. Do you need any services or any assistance?
Moving squatters out is among the final steps before a building is demolished.
Our offices have been in a first-floor, 5-bedroom unit in 3544 South State Street, a building that was completely vacated in preparation for demolition. We're sort of living out the last days and hours of this building as its only inhabitants.
Jamie Calvin's office, now located in one of 2 buildings awaiting the wrecking ball, feels like an old-time settlement house. It's home to a public health outreach program and a job placement center. Social workers and legal clinics hold office hours. His stories document the lives of residents who move through the office. A rhythm and blues singer who left the stage to mother an autistic child. A woman who squatted at Stateway and supported 10 grandchildren on security guard wages. The pain of young men who are banned from their homes after drug arrests on Housing Authority property. Jamie Calvin wants these stories to get out.
I felt it very important to be a point of access for journalists who wanted to talk directly with residents. If you haven't really established a set of relationships in a place like this, these are hard stories to cover. And so we've looked for ways to facilitate the work of other journalists. And we're completely non-proprietary about our work.
The other hat that Jamie wears, of course, is that he also is an organizer down there.
Writer Alex Kotlowitz has turned to Calvin to guide him through Stateway Gardens.
He's working with people, and he knows whose stories are more credible than others. He knows who to talk to, who to listen to. And so he has this insight and this perspective that I think most other journalists don't have.
Chicago Sun-Times reporter Kate Grossman profiled Stateway Gardens squatters in one of many pieces based in part on Calvin's sources. The same day, Calvin posted a squatter story on View from the Ground. Although Grossman relies on Calvin for sources, access, and even perspective, she knows his input comes with a point of view.
He definitely has an agenda, and it's not as if every time he calls me up with something that he's bugged about or that he thinks the housing authority should deal with, I'm going to write about it, because I know that he's got his own agenda, but I've worked with him enough that I trust his judgment.
Calvin introduced Chicago literary icon Studs Terkel to Pete Haywood, a reformed Stateway gangbanger profiled in Terkel's book Will the Circle Be Unbroken? The story is posted on The View. Terkel remembers walking through Stateway Gardens.
It was quite an experience going through the dark corridors. There were a lot of drug guys around, druggies, guys selling things, hollering, hound dog or...
The word is dogface. That's the brand name of heroin that was sold in the building.
It's a phrase through which they contact those who buy, and those who buy are primarily middle-class whites. You see them coming through in their porches and their SUVs, and envelopes are exchanged. All this is going on as I'm passing the corridors, and my guide, my Cicerone, the Virgil to my Dante, is Jamie Calvin. They look at me, shadowy figures. Then they see Jamie and their eyes light. Oh, Jamie. And he was my pass.
Calvin's unlimited access to Stateway Gardens has not come without a price.
There are a lot of downsides to this. I mean, here we are in this bunker, squatting in a doomed public housing building. I'm scrambling to get money in the bank so our phones don't get cut off in the next 24 hours. On the other hand, I have complete freedom to go at stories the way I want to.
Calvin says his greatest compensation is the day-to-day satisfaction of immersing himself in what he calls a fabulously interesting and important story. Like the residents he covers, Calvin is moving from a demolished building to a condemned one, half a block down State Street. For On the Media, I'm Ron Feimster.
And now for a few of your letters. Nancy Doyle of Minneapolis thanked us for our interview with Greg Mitchell of Editor and Publisher on the poor accounting of anti-war protests in Washington last month. And she notes that, quote, "I heard a lot of reporters in various cities categorizing the crowd as college-age youth and aging baby boomers. Translation, impassioned, forgivable children and washed-up grown-ups reliving the Vietnam era. If everyone who attended came to address their own emotional needs rather than to make a substantive point, they are easier to dismiss."
But Betty Metzger of New York City was disappointed with our treatment of the story. "Why did someone not talk to the reporters at NPR and the New York Times," she writes, "about why their original stories were so off the mark and about what caused them to write more accurate stories later in the week? Real reporting with the reporters who covered the protests would have informed us all."
On our story about the Army's new recruitment video game, David Bardsley of the 30th Infantry Brigade wrote in with this. "I am a 7-year and counting veteran in the Army, and I was curious enough to go online and try the game out. I was immediately impressed. Though I don't think the game is going to have 17-year-olds begging their parents to sign their enlistment papers, I do think it gives 15- to 25-year-olds a small taste of what training, teamwork, and esprit de corps are about."
Surprising as it may seem, your letters do contribute to our esprit de corps, so keep them coming. But please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. I got an email the other day from a friend of my mom. She said I had to run, not walk, to this independent flick called Manna from Heaven.
"It's a gift from God.
Many years ago, I told you the money was a gift.
You ever hear about a bunch of money disappearing from here a number of years ago? Maybe a big heist?
Nevada, New York, Illinois, Kentucky, Florida. The list just goes on with no pattern at all.
The story is about a Buffalo, New York family that suddenly has cash raining down on them, changing their lives materially and spiritually forever. It's a movie I probably would never have noticed had I not been grassroots marketed into attending by Five Sisters Productions, the family team that, among them, wrote, produced, directed, acted, and now is independently distributing Manna from Heaven, against the chance that it will become the next My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Joining me now is about 60% of Five Sisters Productions, Gabrielle, Charity, and Ursula Burton. Ladies, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having us. Yep, we're really glad to be here.
Now, you shoot the movie, you edit the movie, and you have a finished film, Manna from Heaven. How do you get it in theaters?
Normally, movies, a filmmaker makes a movie, sells it to a distribution company. The distribution company hires a booking company, and the booking company works with the theaters to get it out. And what we came up against was that the top distributors watched the movie. All of them really were very positive about it, but they said it just hasn't been done before, that a feel-good American independent hasn't been marketed successfully, and independent feel-good movies are expected to be British. They were interested in distributing the movie in New York and L.A. for a weekend, seeing if it stuck, and not putting much marketing money into it. So we said, well, why don't we just not put the marketing money into it, you know, go around and pass out our green flyers and see how it goes. And it's been really surprising a lot of places.
Now, when the distributors were telling you, you know, you're neither fish nor fowl, we don't really know how to do this, no, we're going to pass, you must have been quite demoralized. But at the same time, My Big Fat Greek Wedding was becoming the phenomenon that it is, and it was the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill, gathering mass and speed as it moved. I assume that you're thinking in terms of Big Fat Greek Wedding and hoping that you can duplicate that miracle.
Yeah, we had come up with that idea of marketing a movie like this, very similar to what Greek Wedding then went and did. And they clearly had that same idea, that there's an underserved audience of filmgoers who do want to see feel-good but intelligent and witty, entertaining films. the hardest thing is really getting over the hump of the opening weekend. The whole business is geared toward movies performing huge box office on the opening weekend. A lot of people complain there aren't movies out there, but they don't go out on the opening weekend. And they usually, a discriminating audience that would like Manna from Heaven will wait 2 weeks to read the reviews, get some sense from their friends who've seen it, and by that point it might be gone.
Now, my wife and I went to see Manna from Heaven, and we walked into the theater, and we were about to buy our tickets, when you, Gabrielle, practically ran across the lobby and tackled us in order to get us to make the decision to buy the ticket for Manna from Heaven. Now, that's grassroots when you're actually physically subduing individual movie patrons.
Well, we basically hang out at the theaters for the first couple of weeks. And what was interesting was people love the idea of directors and producers being in the theater and meeting them and then talking to them after.
If every single one of the people that we meet likes the movie and brings back 10 friends, that's the goal.
So it's kind of like a chain letter with popcorn.
Yes. we do give out these pages after where we say, if you can do 5 things for the 5 sisters, 1 for each sister, and one of them is telling 5 of your friends, emailing them to come to the movie. And what we're hoping is that people will be telling their friends and family around the country. And then once we're moving across country on our Whistle Stop tour with the movie, it'll get an audience bigger and bigger. Sort of like Greek Wedding did.
Let me ask you the cold, hard question. Are you going to make it?
Well, we hope so.
I
think the hardest thing is getting over that hurdle of the whole market of movie distribution being geared to the opening box office. And they almost have it down to a science, which really every movie pretty much corresponds to. A movie opens, it loses 30 to 50% of its box office the second week, 30 to 50% the third week, and by the fifth week, it's usually pretty much gone. And what happened with Manna from Heaven was the third weekend in Kansas City, it doubled its box office. And so that really popped up on the radar for the exhibitors, the theaters. So they've said, this is very interesting, and if there's a way that we can get people to come out earlier, they can handle the pressure from a lot of the product that's out there from the studios, because studios need theater space as well for their blockbusters, and really it just comes down to, it's a business. It's not immoral or moral. Hollywood's just making movies that sell tickets.
Well, listen, all best of luck to you with Manna from Heaven. Gabrielle, Ursula, and Charity Burton, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, can I say, people should check on our website for where the movie's going, because it's going all around the country, and it'll be opening wider in January. And our website's www.fivesistersproductions.com. That's all spelled out.
Gabrielle, Charity, and Ursula Burton are filmmakers who created the Capra-esque indie Manna from Heaven. Another indie filmmaker is our old friend Harry Shearer, host of Public Radio's Le Show. Shearer wrote, directed, and starred in Teddy Bear's Picnic, a send-up of the famous annual retreat of the rich and powerful called Bohemian Grove. Teddy Bear's Picnic also got short-shrifted by the big distributors, and Shearer has been reduced to flogging the film himself. Harry, welcome to the big show.
Thank you, Bob.
We just spoke with three charming women who have a charming, very hopeful, optimistic film called Manna from Heaven. They didn't get distribution for it, and they were trying to do it themselves. Are they going to make it?
I would be loath to say yes or no, but this is a weird marketplace. It has been jiggered by the major studios to basically be about spending a huge amount of money to open a film. Probably starting with a movie I was in, Godzilla, which got pilloried for spending $50 million on marketing costs, which today is table stakes. You have to spend that kind of money to be heard in the clatter of other studios spending $50 to $60 million to open their movies. So a little independent that's creeping through or trying to creep through is utterly dependent on so-called free media and on your ability to charm, threaten, cajole, plead, beg news and feature editors to write stories about your film, because that's the only way the public's going to find out about it.
Was there any point when Teddy Bear's Picnic had the possibility of not being an independent and getting distribution from an actual distributor?
Well, it was distributed by an actual distributor in San Francisco and New York for its opening, and they hired the publicist, and they were responsible, the distributor, and they were responsible for getting the publicist to try to get the free media. But, you know, a friend who is also a publicist told me midway through the process, you know, this is going to disgust you, but you're going to have to start making those calls yourself. And so I started calling people and saying, you got to do this. You got to put me on the air.
Was there something rewarding about trying to get this free media, or was it, you know, the single most degrading experience of your life or something in between?
It was not in between. It was the second. It was utterly degrading and humiliating, frustrating and infuriating. I came up in journalism and for a long time had regarded people in journalism as kind of kindred spirits, unlike most people in Hollywood who view them as the enemy. So it came as a shock to me that I ended up having to shorten the list of so-called friends in the media drastically. My favorite story about it is that my local hometown newspaper, which you'll have to do some research to find out the name of, I don't intend to promote them, informed my publicity people that they weren't going to write a word about this film that I had out earlier this year for the simple reason that, quote, they had written too much about me. So I Googled myself, which is not illegal in this state, and found out that basically what that meant is that when their reporters had called me for quotes about stories they were writing about other people, I had been so obtuse as to cooperate with them. No, in the no good deed goes unpunished file, we must put that. So
you didn't get any publicity. And by the way, the Los Angeles Times for Teddy Bear's Picnic. Sorry. This is something that had to be done. Word of mouth has always been said to be what actually fuels a film. But is the marketing juggernaut so important now that it even defeats the organic nature of word of mouth?
Yes, word of mouth can sometimes help a heavily marketed film. It almost never can help an unmarketed film because you won't be in the theaters by the time the word of mouth has hit the right ears. But the thing about releasing a movie theatrically, however well it does on first blush, is it has this odd life and sometimes this odd afterlife. Spinal Tap really never caught on until its second afterlife. And so this movie is creeping around now, playing weeks in Pittsburgh. It just did. It's going to be in Providence and Boston. And it just sort of hitchhiking its way around the country.
So it's still alive, and there's still some chance that it will pick up steam, that it will become the snowball rolling down the hill, that it will do the impossible?
I don't think that. I think it just, you know, people can still see it. I think that's betting way against the odds at this point. But, you know, what your other guests will find is no matter whether that snowball thing happens or not, people will see the movie, and that's why you made it.
Well, Harry Shearer, good luck with Teddy Bear's Picnic.
Thank you, Bob.
A certified comic genius, Harry Shearer is the writer and director of Teddy Bear's Picnic and also the producer and talent behind Le Show, distributed by KCRW in Santa Monica.
Next up, England's tobacco ad ban and Britain's celebrity drought, also saving kids from commercials.
This is On the Media from NPR. Back with On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Federal Communications Commission doesn't set rules on how much time commercials can take up, except around children's programming. But to some parents, those limits are not nearly enough, and they've launched a new effort to get Congress to eliminate all TV advertising to children under the age of 12. Similar restrictions have been put into law in Sweden, Denmark, and Belgium. Commercial ban organizers here say they're gaining support from parents who don't like what kid marketers are selling. OTM's Paul Ingalls reports.
All right, the Explorer. Next on CBS.
It's a typical Saturday morning on network TV with Dora the Explorer on CBS.
Why, I oughta.
Catch you later, windbag.
Timo Supremo here on ABC.
Wolf spider. Woo! Look at the fangs on her.
That's Croc Files on NBC and over at Fox, Ultraman.
So you see, son. This is a chance to sharpen your skills.
And amidst all the action and learning, plenty of commercials. With kids...
Kool-Aid jammers!
Targeted squarely at kids.
McDonald's Galador Happy Meal toys. Bigger, stronger, cooler than ever.
While the networks and cable channels bill their children's blocks as the best in educational or animated fun, media reformers and some parents see it differently. As a system that merely delivers kids to advertisers.
Given that kids don't have a lot of money themselves, you know, when you're advertising to four-year-olds and five-year-olds, what are you doing? What you're doing is you're trying to convince kids to pester their parents, to lobby them for particular kinds of products.
University of Massachusetts professor Sut Jolly directs the Media Education Foundation, and he spoke last month to teachers and media activists at a conference in Albuquerque.
The media have no interest in the health and well-being of our kids. There is no moral justification for advertising to kids. You cannot make a moral justification.
And so Jolly and other media reformers, along with some parents' groups, spanning from conservative to liberal, are signing on to a Parents' Bill of Rights, written by Ralph Nader's Commercial Alert Organization.
The idea of the Parents' Bill of Rights is that it's simply impossible for parents to control the commercial influences over their children's lives anymore.
Gary Ruskin, executive director of Commercial Alert, whose document claims a link between corporate marketers of candy and soda pop and rising rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes in kids. And Ruskin doesn't stop there.
They're being fed a list of values like materialism and violence and antisocial behavior and hedonism that nearly all parents really don't agree with.
Ruskin says the answer is legislation, and the Parents' Bill of Rights suggests 9 possible state or federal laws he expects supporters will be lobbying for soon. They range from eliminating the tax deduction for advertising to children under 12, to removing commercial interests from schools, to the big one, banning all television advertising aimed at kids under 12, a law some others say will never fly.
It's the First Amendment. It really is. It protects commercial speech as well.
Scott Donatan, editor of Advertising Age magazine.
And as long as they're legal products advertised in a truthful manner, then there's no reason to block these messages, to regulate these messages. And I think it's ridiculously over the top to call them evil. Vote with your remote controls. Vote with your dollars. If you don't like that a company is sponsoring something, don't buy their products. If you don't like a show, don't turn it on.
Donatan says overall the ad industry does a good job of policing itself, and he points to groups like the Children's Advertising Review Unit of the Better Business Bureau, which monitor ads during children's programming for appropriateness. KRU, as it's called, is directed by Elizabeth Lascousse, who tells of one spot they went after recently. It looked like a kids' show, she said, with a woman train conductor and a man in a whale outfit singing Sharing is Caring.
As they were singing, the whale started pointing at some juicy fruit in the woman's overall pocket. And she got, while still singing with her teeth clenched, angrier and angrier, and shook her head no, while singing Sharing is Caring. And so the whale reached over and took it, and she ran after him and decked him with a flying tackle. And when he stood up, his eye was hanging out and his tooth was missing, and then she ripped off his slipper and started beating him with it. We didn't think that was appropriate for children's television, obviously.
KRU got Wrigley's to pull the spot from kids' shows, although it still runs some on late-night TV. Lascousse says since most parents don't know about KRU as a place to lodge complaints about ads, they've handled only about 10 parental protests in the last 10 years. But also, she thinks that the industry largely keeps itself from crossing a line that would alarm parents.
You really don't want to make the parents of your target audience upset with you. So the kid marketers, the traditional kid marketers, know what the rules are. Sometimes they'll push a little bit on the creative end and we push back, but they know what the rules are and they basically play by them.
Commercial Alert's Gary Ruskin calls KRU's monitoring, quote, a rigged system in that ad challenges are heard by panels dominated by ad industry personnel, and KRU itself is funded by ad industry money. Ruskin labels the result, quote, weak standards for judging what's appropriate in advertising to children. It's one reason Ruskin is pushing for new laws and pinning his hope on getting a few key legislators to sign on as sponsors. He says since many elected reps are parents too, some may join his cause.
Jericho, come on!
A quick survey of parents waiting for their kids outside an Albuquerque elementary school turned up mixed responses, ranging from "Where do I sign?" to doubters like Catherine Cooper.
I think it's problematic. First, I don't understand how you can ban advertising for children 12 and under. I think it would be a problem as to who's going to decide what is good or what isn't good for children 12 and under. I don't think it's possible.
Undaunted by concerns like these, supporters of a kids' commercial ban say the first step is to get the conversation going on the topic. So they're vowing to get the Parents' Bill of Rights posted in as many daycare centers, schools, churches, synagogues, and grocery stores as possible in the months ahead. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
A movement against tobacco advertising is rolling across Europe. A year ago, British American Tobacco, Philip Morris, JT International, and several other companies launched a new Code of Global Marketing Standards, attempting to ensure that no tobacco advertising is directed to youth. And in the last month, we have seen Britain's Tobacco Advertising and Promotion Bill. Originally introduced by Lord Clement Jones, a Liberal Democrat, the anti-tobacco advertising bill recently cleared its last parliamentary hurdle, and it passed unopposed through the House of Commons.
The specifics are still being worked out, but it looks like tobacco advertising will be banned in Britain by year's end. We reached Mark Kleinman, chief reporter for Marketing Magazine, on the line from his busy newsroom to discuss how the ad ban is likely to play out. My first question: how do brands do their branding without advertising? In other words, what will make one particular brand stand out from the pack?
Well, I think the major battleground is, as already said, about price. If the premium brands aren't able to promote themselves in their traditional ways, i.e. through brand advertising, then clearly price is going to become a more important factor in the sale marketing of tobacco brands.
So if Marlboro can't craft an image, it's going to have to compete with the generic cigarette brand on price alone.
Absolutely. You've already seen that in the past, where Philip Morris has had to invest a hell of a lot of money in price cuts just to ensure that brands such as Marlboro can compete with the discount brands.
It seems as if the tobacco companies will have to resort to some extent to word of mouth.
Well, I think that word of mouth is obviously important in any consumer brand sector, not just in tobacco, but as you rightly point out, in a sector where above-the-line communications are banned, they need to have brand ambassadors, people who are going to go and spread the word, to go into bars and nightclubs and, you know, either distribute their cigarettes or to encourage people to sample them and hopefully then spread the message of that brand.
So in-person promoters would still be allowed?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, what about product placement in movies or even in video games?
That is an option open to the tobacco companies, but you have to remember that now they've signed up to the global marketing standards to which the major companies like Philip Morris, British American Tobacco and Japan Tobacco International have signed up to. If they're serious about presenting a more responsible image, they're going to have to shy away from any kind of marketing discipline, which leaves them open to accusations of exploitation. I think films are another matter, but at the same time, you have to also remember that when Eddie Murphy was seen in Beverly Hills Cop 20 years ago smoking Lucky Strike branded cigarettes, there was a huge controversy even then, and I think the same outrage would apply even now.
Are the tobacco companies fighting back?
Absolutely. I think a lot of the work that the tobacco companies are doing is necessarily behind the scenes, and we're not privy to it. You saw that there was a website which British American Tobacco launched last year, which was extremely furtive and clandestine, and basically it was a website which promoted bars and nightclubs which stocked BAT brands, but there was no BAT branding on this website. So increasingly, the tobacco companies are finding other ways to target smokers through lifestyle-based communications. For example, in Amsterdam, in Holland, there is a shop, a retail outlet, which is basically a bar and entertainment venue where smokers can go. It's entirely funded by British American Tobacco. The tobacco companies are fighting back, and they will continue to do so, of course.
You know, it's funny, but the view from this side of the pond is that Europe is just replete with smokers who smoke happily with no shame, while in the United States, smokers cower in doorways and stand in the rain and are generally regarded as the scum of the earth. So I wonder how the ban on tobacco advertising where you are either reflects or is likely to change the culture of smoking in Britain.
I think that across Europe now, with Brussels intervening more and more in national legislation, you're seeing a trend whereby smokers are made to feel increasingly ostracized, that they should be only allowed to smoke in certain places. And there are even calls in the UK media today referring to a complete ban on smoking in public places. So certainly the restrictions on smokers' rights are becoming increasingly draconian.
Do experts really believe that the advertising ban will stop smokers from smoking or keep new smokers from starting?
The government claims that it will save 3,000 lives a year in the UK alone, which is obviously a tremendous number. But you would have to ask the question then, that if that's the case, then why, when the tobacco advertising ban was a manifesto commitment by Labour in 1997, has it taken 5 years to get the bill through Parliament? The fact is that you could argue that the delay has cost 15,000 lives if you apply the government's arithmetic.
Mark, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I'm going to guess that you're not a smoker.
You're absolutely right.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Mark Kleinman is chief reporter for Marketing Magazine. Also in England this week, police were questioning 9 people in the plot to kidnap singer Victoria Beckham, known to millions of fans as Posh Spice of Spice Girls fame and the wife of English soccer star David Beckham. The arrests followed a tip-off by the News of the World tabloid, which said its reporters had infiltrated a gang of Romanian and Albanian kidnappers who planned to use a chemical spray to sedate her and her sons Brooklyn and Romeo if they were with her. The Queen should award an OBE to the News of the World, because losing Posh would mean losing a sizable percentage of Britain's celebrities, as Bob uncharitably observed during a stopover in England.
You've looked after loads of celebrities and made them up.
Yeah.
Which one's your favourite? Who's your favourite?
Oh, God, there's loads. I do loads, but I really like doing Gail Port. She's absolutely brilliant. I do Melanie Sykes, Melinda Messenger.
Oh,
I mean,
wow. Just
all ranges. You know,
sorry,
all
I hate to do
Gail Porter, Melanie Sykes, and Melinda Messenger. Who in the world are Gail Porter, Melanie Sykes, and Melinda Messenger? They're nobody. That's who they are. Great Britain is at the moment so painfully bereft of world-class celebrities that their demi-celebrity chat show hostesses are reduced to interviewing demi-celebrity hairdressers about the demi-celebrity entertainers whom you almost certainly have never heard of. For a country that produced Richard Burton, Julie Andrews, 007 Sean Connery, Princess Diana, and the Beatles, the current celebrity drought is an embarrassment and a heartbreak.
Any time you went to an event, you always knew you had to put your best dinner suit and bow tie on. It's been a long time since I wore a dinner suit and a bow tie.
Richard Young is a freelance celebrity photographer who has been shooting pop stars and royalty for 40 years.
People I'm going to photograph in London doesn't really warrant it. And I look around me and I see this, the people that everybody is going mad about. And I think to myself, these are not stars. How, for crying out loud, can these people have the audacity to call themselves celebrities?
Who are the big celebrities in the United Kingdom right now?
I guess you'd say Robbie Williams, Gordon Brown.
Let me ask you a follow-up question, please. Who are Robbie Williams and Gordon Brown?
Well, one is a pop star, one's a politician.
Here's the one who isn't a politician.
Hell is gone.
The song is titled Let Me Entertain You. You can hear it on your favorite Top 40 station, Never.
Excuse me. I'm Bob Garfield from National Public Radio in Washington. Can I ask you a question? Who are your big celebrities?
It's got to be David Beckham's wife, yeah. Posh Spice.
Big celebrities in England. Nasser Hussain, the English cricket captain. He's one of my favourites.
I know, Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise, American.
Yeah, Christina Ricci, Michelle Pfeiffer.
American.
Yeah, worldwide, I think most of the big actors and actresses are American.
David Beckham, I suppose, and his wife, Posh.
That's the best you can come up with.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Isn't that a pitiful state of affairs?
Sad.
It's worse than sad. It's pathetic. Whenever Britain comes up with a decent celebrity, Anthony Hopkins, Elizabeth Hurley, say, they pick up and move to the United States, where we have Hollywood and a superior way of life. Indeed, like Russia with wheat and North Korea with rice, the Britannia that for decades exported its big stars, its music, and its fashion now is reduced to importing from the States. Madonna's arrival has given Fleet Street a chance to hound somebody significant for the first time since the death of Princess Diana. It's all a sign, says University of Sussex Media Studies professor Andy Medhurst, of a nation that is living so obsessively in the past that it has lost its grip on the present.
England's become a kind of theme park country for lots of people who visit here. They have the things they tick off. It's like Disneyland with royalty. Things they want to take home with them are the images and memories of the English past. I mean, the English present doesn't interest many people outside England.
Witness Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery, a movie that spoofs the time when Britain was setting the cultural agenda for the world.
Oh, behave. Yeah, baby! Yeah.
And he's a Canadian who's become an American pretending to be an Englishman, so there you go.
How embarrassing is that? But this tragic dearth of Indigenous celebrity resources isn't merely embarrassing. It's the final proof, after the march of the Euro, the flop of the Millennium Dome, and the U.S. military domination of the Balkan crisis, that the country that defeated the Spanish Armada, that controlled colonies on four continents, that faced down Hitler, is now completely irrelevant to the rest of the world. What Robbie Williams proves, once and for all, is that the sun has set on the British Empire. Professor Medhurst.
The days when we could claim to have sort of cultural dominance across the Atlantic certainly are long, long gone. I think what we have to do is recognize where our place on the global ladder is. And we always had a very inflated idea of where that was. And I guess now we're having to face facts. You know, we're a small island off the northwest coast of Europe, which is not a bad thing. It's just the thing that is.
They've given us their language. They've given us their common law. They've given us their muffins. Once upon a time, the British wove an exquisite tapestry of accomplishment. Now they are a faded, musty dropcloth of a former world power, and if you expect them to continue entertaining us, you can just put it out of your mind. The princess is dead. Long live Madonna.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go on.
Who are your big celebrities?
You know, I don't know at the moment. I really can't bring anyone to mind. Sorry.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurganker. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
These are not stars.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.